Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At the time we've been in the thick net, my little monologue says that for those who haven't heard what the thick net is, it's a gathering of amateur radio operators. They share information about their favorite hobby, the 26 different kinds of ham radio. And there's a lot to be learned about how those transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, propagation, modes of operation, how all that stuff works. Lots of brain power in the New York City area. We try to tap into that. The TechNet is a very adaptable thing, we claim. In other words, if you know of a better way that we should be conducting it, what we should do first, second, third, how long we should do it, make your suggestions. The current form that it's in is an adaptation of a whole, I guess it's about the fourth or fifth reincarnation of the TechNet as far as the way we change, the way we do things. Let me drop. Right now, the usual format is that we take questions, we take call letters and names in the beginning from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. We try to handle all of those people within the first hour or so, maybe hour and a half. So in theory, you don't have to wait very long to get at least a brief answer. After those initial questions and answers, we go over to KC2WGB, has been collecting what we sometimes call Mel's Corner, or we call the Dropbox, but by sending emails to him, and eventually there's going to be a specific website at the Limark page. A person who doesn't have his license yet, can't get on the air, but has questions or answers, particularly beginners. John collects a number of those, and the ones that have general interest, we go through those next. The third thing we do is that Paul, WS2N, our space expert, is something interesting has been going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Paul gives us a bit of a rundown on that. After the general business that you just heard, questions and answers, new people with questions, and the space report, after that we go into deeper subjects. Quite often they're ham radio subjects. Quite often they're on that ongoing research going on in the New York City area where scientists like people are trying to copy or at least duplicate what is taking place in Europe, which is an ongoing experiment that is investigating ways of generating power and possibly ways of generating power more efficiently. That particular material is done at the wee hours of the morning, late at the TechNet. That doesn't appeal to everybody, we know that, but we're reasonably convinced that at that time, at say 11:30 at night or so, this repeater would ordinarily be quiet. So to have that material of narrow interest to some people at that time, hopefully it doesn't offend anyone. If it does, then in some cases it's somebody just wishing they had more power over what takes place when and where. That's one possible explanation. So at this time we're going to take questions and we're going to take sign-ins for people who do have a question or a comment for the net. I'd like to believe there are a few people out there that are not watching the Super Bowl. We'll soon find out. Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2PJF with a question.
KC2RFN Allen, yes.
KC2BHY, yes.
K2MU Bernie, yes.
And WS2N Paul with a space report.
KC2WGB with a question after Paul.
Okay, that happened a little bit fast. First one was WA2PJF. What is your name, sir?
Vito. Vito like the Godfather. Vito, Bayshore, New York.
We got Vito from Bayshore. And then I skipped somebody by mistake. KD2BHY and K2MU, we got those. But there was another person I skipped. Who was that? KC2RFN. Never heard of him. Okay. All righty. BHY, who I think is Jim. And K2MU, did you tell me your name, sir?
K2MU, Bernie.
You sure did. I didn't get a chance to write it down. Okay. So we've got Vito, Alan, Jim, and Bernie. Did I skip anybody? Is there anyone else? Tango Zulu Golf. We got you, Joe. And also John. I should list him. All right, you've got more than enough to get started. I'm amazed we got that many people during a Super Bowl. Vito, you're number one on the runway. WA2 Papa Juliet Foxtrot. Go right ahead with your question. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
And Dick, you got me for the space report, WS2N, correct?
We sure do, Paul. Not to worry. Go ahead, Vito.
Okay, Dick, good evening. If I may, I've never quite understood the language or the terminology or the whatever of a switching power supply. What I'm referring to is the fact that I have two miniature, small size, 45 amp switching power supplies, and I had a much larger one, about double the size of this little one, at only 30 amps. Now, why is it that the switching power supply is a higher current rating, higher current rated one that I happen to possess, own, is much smaller in size than the larger one at lower amperage? And what does the switching actually represent, if I may? Back to you, Dick.
I think that's a rather good question, Vito. And I suspect less than half of the amateurs know the difference between the two. If this was, let me pick a number, 1970, and you and I were designing a 45 ampere power supply that gives out 12 volts, we would start off with a very healthy sized transformer. 45 amperes at 12 volts is around 500 watts. So it's a 500 watt size transformer, taking 110 volts in on the primary, and it would be producing something like 15 volts on the secondary. You and I would rectify that 15 volts, put it into a great big filter capacitor, probably hundreds if not thousands of microfarads, and then do some kind of voltage regulation with regulating transistors. Maybe the rectified voltage out of that transformer would give us something like 15 volts DC. The regulating transistors would regulate that down to 12 or 13 volts by which we run the rig. So the real size of that thing is the iron of the transformer and the amount of heat sinking required, because those transistors in my example will in some cases be dropping 3, 4, and 5 volts at 45 amperes, which means they're going to be dissipating 150 watts, the series regulating transistors. That's a conventional analog power supply. Let me drop. Along came some smart guys who decided that another way of building a power supply is to not use the power transformer at all in many cases. The power transformer elimination means that you just take the 110 volt line, rectify it directly in some cases. If I take the 120 volt AC and rectify it, it's got 167 volts peak. And if I rectify that, I'm going to get something like 150 volts DC into my filter capacitor. So no power transformer, a simple bridge rectifier into a capacitor, and I've got 150 volts. But I don't want 150 volts. I want 15 volts. I want 13.8 volts, we'll say. That's a lot of voltage drop. Okay, one of the ways you can do that voltage dropping is by using transistors as a switch, probably at a very high frequency rate, maybe 100 kilohertz. I'm now going to turn the transistor on from the 150 volt power supply, 150 volt capacitor, down to the capacitor that's going to give me 13.8 volts of output. I've got in between the two a transistor that's acting like a switch, but the switch is not directly connecting 150 volts to the 13.8 terminal. It's connecting it through an inductor. So I close the switch. 150 volts is applied across the inductor for a certain period of time. Then I open the switch. The inductor, in turn, has a certain amount of stored magnetic energy. It gives an inductive kickback by way of a catching diode. In other words, when I open up the switch between the 150 volt supply and the 13.8 volt output, I'm charging that inductor. There's a diode there to make sure that the switch opened goes to ground on the input side of the inductor. the output side of the inductor, the current that flows.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The current that flows into the 13.8 output terminal and its capacitor. Now, by adjusting the pulse width modulation, in other words, I could turn on that transistor that's coupling the 150 volts through the inductor into the capacitor output. I could turn that on 1% of the time, 5% of the time, 10% of the time. I'm doing it with a square wave at something like 150 kilohertz rate. And so the inductor is averaging that, and what it's doing is it's stepping down the voltage for me in a lossless manner. That switch is either full on, which means there's no voltage drop across it, even though 45 amperes is flowing, or it's completely off, no voltage, no current is flowing through it. And so the switching transistor is fully on or fully off. In theory, it's dissipating no power. The inductor, if it's got high enough quality, it's dissipating no power. So it becomes a lossless network that adjusts the voltage output. It regulates the output voltage by this pulse width modulation. In other words, I could make that output waveform at 13.8 volts go up, go down. I could adjust it in all kinds of ways by just adjusting the percentage of time that that switching transistor is in the conducting mode. What you heard is just a very slight thumbnail sketch of the beginning of the operation. If you do Google the word switching power supply or switching regulator, you'll see some schematics somewhat like what I'm discussing, and you'll get a little bit more theory of operation. But because you've eliminated 500 watts worth of iron, because you've eliminated 500 watts of dissipation of a series pass regulating transistor, you've now only got a few watts of dissipation of a switching transistor. You've got a small inductor running at a 100 KC rate. Let me drop. So the whole power supply now consists of a fairly small switching transistor, a fairly small heatsink on it, a fairly small inductor running at 100 KC, some reasonably high-quality capacitors, and a bridge rectifier rectifying the input power. The net result is that the power supply that used to run at, let me pick a number, 60% efficiency, now runs at 95% efficiency. It used to be a great big bulky object that was hard to move, heavy, and took up a lot of volume. It's now a much smaller thing, much lighter, smaller, more efficient. There's only one catch here, Vito, and that is because I am now doing all the voltage control at a 100 KC switching rate, if you're not a little bit careful with the way you design it, I could be generating harmonics all the way up the band every 100 KC. I could make a whole lot of spurious signals with this switching power supply if I'm not careful. There are ways of doing fancy filtering and fancy shielding to get around that problem, but with that one slight exception, you can see it's a win-win situation, so that many of the power supplies that are in our rigs today, or many of the power supplies we use to run all of our 12-volt equipment in the shack, are switching-type power supplies. They're rather popular. The designs have been around now for a long time. They've been reasonably well refined. Most of the bugs are out of them, so to speak. And some of them have got some beautiful protect circuits built in where if the voltage going in is too high or too low, and by the way, that power supply I just described to you, you'll see that I could run that on 220 volts, 110 volts. I could probably put 50 volts AC into it, and if it's got enough dynamic range to the way it does its switching, it'll still continue to give you 13.8 volts output at 45 amperes. They're very forgiving, these switching-type power supplies. I know it's not going to all make sense at first, but at least you've got a bit of an introduction to it, Vito. WA2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I have a very good idea now. I can see as you were speaking, visually see that in my mind. So I'm going to say now that we have an actual switching procedure in progress here. I believe unijunction transistors are used for switching. I'm guessing if that's what they are, if I'm correct in saying so. And you're telling me finally at the end of this little conversation here that if I were to take a piece of equipment that required, let's say, 40 amps, and I can very safely power that item with no damage to the switching power supply, how can I say this now, without damaging the power supply or the transistors, as I could draw the same amperage from the big powerhouse, the big one you mentioned earlier, that will not damage that at all. But I'm just concerned that if the 40 amps is the same 40 amps in both cases, that's what I need to know. Okay, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, now you want to read your owner's manual. You want to read the data sheet fairly carefully. Let me make sure. Okay, I got the right switches plugged in here. You want to read that manual fairly carefully, Vito. If the original great big power transformer type power supply was rated for 45 amps, and if your little bitty switching power supply is also rating for 45 amps, the 45 amps of one and the 45 amps of the other is the same. The voltage is the same, as long as you're using it within its proper capability. And some of the better made switching power supplies have output current limiting, they have short circuit protection, they have over voltage protection, the better made ones. Now, is your particular one, does it have all of that protection? You're going to have to read the owner's manual to find that out. But the better made ones, you can put a dead short circuit across it and nothing bad happens. You can draw more than, if it's rated for 45 amps and you try to draw 50 amps, it'll just jump down to a lower output voltage, so to speak, and it goes into a self-protect mode and nothing bad happens. So with the proper choice and the proper design, these things are extremely forgiving, and there's a lot more positive about them than negative. The only negative I know of is that if it was poorly designed, it could be making some harmonics that interfere, give you some birdies in your receiver. Let me drop. The actual switching transistors, and nowadays many times they are field effect transistors. I guess some people would call that a unit junction. In other words, there's, between the source and the drain is just one great big bar of a semiconductor material, and there's a gate somewhere in between that controls the current that flows through it. So some of these field effect transistors are used in switching power supplies. Sometimes they're bipolar, sometimes they're field effect. But there are some rather nice devices these days that will operate at those frequencies and very efficiently. They're fully on, fully off, and the transition is a very small number of microseconds or nanoseconds, so that they waste very little power in the transition. They waste almost no power in the full on or the full off mode. So a good switching power supply can run very cold, 90-some-odd percent efficient, and do exactly what you want. So it's a matter of how good is the particular design of the one that you bought, and now between you and the manufacturer, how good a job he did, if you know what I mean, Vito. WA2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very well. Thank you so much. I have been somewhat, mostly enlightened. And I will take your advice and look on Google and get an actual pictorial of the schematic as to what you're saying. It'll make even more sense. Thank you so much. You've been quite informative. And I apologize if I tie things up here. So back to you, Dick. And this is WA2PJF clear. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for listening.
Information note, Dick. Yeah, John, recognize one last piece of information here, Vito, and that is I gave you an example of a kind of switching power supply which is called a buck type. In other words, higher voltage in, lower voltage out. They call that buck. There's also kinds that will boost. In other words, there's a kind of a switching power supply you put 5 volts in and get 50 volts out or 28 volts out. There's boost type, buck boost type. Depending on how you set up that switching transistor, you can do all kinds of fancy things and all very efficiently. And what's your experience with switching power supplies, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, mine are all linears. I don't have any switching. I had them when they were poorly designed, well, much poorly, more poorly very good today. A few of my friends have them, but right now I don't own any. I just wanted to point out that you should get the Bernie@HuntFamily.com point for the people who want to maybe pick that stuff up before we get to that.
Yeah, what John is referring to is that when we get into the more serious stuff, let's say at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, quite often we're referring to a particular website that has particular pictures or particular descriptions of an object, and if you want to be able to read along with us, you can find out the exact addresses of those websites by going to K2 Yankee Oscar's website, where he distributes that information. So K2IO, Bernie, you can go to his website, which is Bernie at HuntFamily.org, is it? Oh, there we go, HuntFamily.com. So Bernie@HuntFamily.com is the URL, is the email address for K2 Yankee Oscar, by which you can find out the addresses of what we'll be discussing later on. The next person on our list was Alan, KC2RFN. What's the latest with you, Alan? And I think you've been doing some fox hunting lately, and I think we're also going to later on maybe be hearing from Don, N2LDY, who is starting to build a very nice dop scan system. KC2RFN, K2RIW. You got it, Alan.
Okay, always good to have another hunter. KC2RFN, good evening, Dick. I'm just following up from two prior TechNet. The first one is from 2 weeks ago. I had said I would look at my cauterizer and note the frequency that they use. It's lower than I thought it would be. It's only 500 kilohertz. I thought it would be in the megahertz, but I double-checked, and it is just around 500 hertz, kilohertz. The second one is last week I had an issue with my the CW side of my transceiver, and someone suggested that perhaps there wasn't a filter in there. And later in the evening, I got a call from Joe at WJTB, and he had figured that while I do have DSP audio filtering, I may not have the IF filter installed. And I opened it up, and sure enough, that was the case. I ordered one used online because they discontinued it for my radio, and received it the other day. Put it in, worked perfectly. I just wanted to say if somebody runs that similar problem where they're not getting any S-meter deflection, but they're getting some attenuation, there's just no filter in the slot. Once I put the filter in, I still had the proper S-meter deflection, but was really able to narrow down. And I honestly don't see how you can do CW without some sort of filtering. Mine, I think, is 500 kilohertz. And there's another one, I think it's 250, but the 500 is like mana from heaven. So that's it, Dick. KC2RFN.
Well done, Alan. You said the filter is 500 kilohertz, and I think you mean 500 hertz. The 500 hertz filter probably is the one you're going to use an awful lot. The 250 hertz, I think you're going to find a little bit too narrow, a little bit too ringy, and a little bit too soft sounding, so to speak. If your 500 hertz filter or the 700 hertz filter was being generated by a digital signal processing program, you can then adjust the exact shape factor, skirt selectivity, damping factor, how much it rings, and so on. You can adjust some of those other characteristics. When you buy a filter that's made for 500 hertz, if it really is a physical object, you know, with inductors and capacitors or quartz inside, you'll have to settle on what it's got and learn to live with those particular characteristics. Let me drop. And I very well remember my early days of Morse code with the Heathkit AR3 receiver in the late 50s as a novice on the 80-meter and 40-meter novice band. And before I added the so-called Q multiplier, which is a kind of a narrow filter you could add, a tunable narrow filter you could add to a Heathkit AR3 receiver. These are old-fashioned pieces of tube equipment that most of you guys won't recognize. Only Rich N2EO will recognize it, or Barry but N2MB will recognize it. But most of the rest of you guys won't recognize these old-fashioned pieces of equipment. In the beginning, and I remember my Morse code reception, my mind got very confused by hearing large number of Morse code signals on slightly different tones, all coming out of the receiver simultaneously. It's kind of hard for you to believe right now, Alan, but as you get more and more practice with Morse code reception, your need for that 500 hertz filter or the 250 hertz filter will decrease. As the human brain gets properly trained for Morse code, you will be able to use human ear selectivity. You'll be developing the equivalent of a digital signal process between your ears. You'll decide you're going to listen to your favorite Morse code guy at 700 hertz, and the guy at 750 up the band a little bit, and the guy at 650 down the band a little bit. You'll be able to completely ignore him, and he won't even give you any annoyance. With enough practice, there's a whole skill set. Listening to Morse code, you maybe have experienced a little bit of it. Let me drop. Where for many people, as you practice Morse code and as your code reception speed capability goes from around 8 or 9 or 10 words per minute, all of a sudden you'll recognize the fact that you're not hearing dots and dashes, you're not hearing dits and dahs, you're starting to hear groupings of sounds. The brain jumps many of the steps of the lookup table, so to speak, and in some cases the hand will write the letter when the sound comes into the earphones, and at first you'll say to yourself, who did that? It's the other half of your brain doing it, if you know what I mean. So with greater practice, you're soon going to discover that narrow filters are not as required. In the beginning, you'll be convinced that only with a narrow filter can you listen to a super weak signal. And with a broadband filter, you can't do that. You'll soon find out that the weakest signal you can listen to with and without a narrow filter or a broad filter will eventually be almost the same. So there's some extra training going to be going on there. I know it's kind of hard to believe, but a couple of years from now, you'll say, yeah, I didn't believe it then, but I'm starting to see it now. Over to you for any other comments, and thank you for those feedbacks, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yeah, I did misspeak. I meant 500 hertz, not kilohertz, obviously. And, yeah, I noticed that as I practice, and I do practice every day, no matter what, and I found that I have to get myself out of the way. The less I think, the faster my hand will write it with greater accuracy. The more I think about it, the more mistakes I make from double thinking. And of course, the code moves on, and then you mess one up, and it creates a domino effect. But very satisfying as they get. I know I'll get it sooner or later. It's falling into place, but it is. It is very convenient to turn the filter on, and you can hear three conversations in Morse code on top of each other. You click it down to 500 hertz or 600 hertz, and boom, only one comes in. It's really like magic. I really recommend. I know a lot of technicians out there are listening, and they got rid of the code, but that's really where great fun in this field is, and I think a lot of people deprive themselves of that because it's a little bit of work. It's worth the effort, in my opinion. Anyway, back to that. Thanks, Dick. I did send you an email about something extremely interesting you might want to check. KC2RFM.
Okay, I last looked at my email at about 7:45. I'll have to go look at it again. Possibly you sent after that time or it arrived after that time. One other thing you're going to notice, Alan, is that in the beginning, when we're learning Morse code, we hear a sound, we want to write down that letter immediately, so the mind is clear in order for the next letter to come along. With practice, you will be lagging. With practice, you will be writing down letters two or three or four letters behind the sound that is now coming in. In other words, those sounds will be going into your brain as if it's a pipeline. And so the brain is processing two or three letters at once in that pipeline, and what you're writing down is two or three or four letters behind what is now coming in. That will occur automatically with greater practice. So you don't have to force yourself to write the letter immediately to clear your brain to get ready for the next letter. Once you do that delay type technique, all of a sudden, a letter that becomes troublesome is no, it doesn't bind up the system anywhere near as bad, if you know what I mean. A chunk of punctuation comes along, and all of a sudden everything stops, and you miss the next two or three letters if you're insisting on writing them down immediately. So practice on some delay, if you know what I mean. And the real good guys do that. And another amazing thing that starts happening is that you and I are in the stage right now where we hear a series of dots and dashes, da 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 da, and the brain says B, or the hand writes down the letter B, uppercase or lowercase, whichever way you do it. And so we hear letters at a time. With further practice, even with this delay, people start hearing whole words and even fractions of sentences. But the word B-E-N-T, for instance, got a very fancy swing to it, and you'll eventually recognize da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the word B-E-N-T. In Morse code, you'll hear it as one complete sound eventually, as opposed to individual letters. And there's other words like that, like the word commission. If you're taking down a whole lot of practice Morse code copy where they talk about the Federal Communications Commission, with the double M and double S in commission, it's got a very characteristic sound, if you know what I mean. So Morse code can be fun. It's a beautiful art form, and it's a beautiful proof of how adaptable a human brain is. The next person on our list was Jim, KD2BHY. What's the latest with you, Jim? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. I'm currently studying for my general, but I've had a little bit of trouble. The ARRL General Class Manual, I was on the circuitry and theory chapter, and I didn't understand this decibel thing, this whole big equation. So I asked my dad for help, and we spent an hour and a half deciphering the equation, and we understood three-quarters of it. And then we went to the question pool and realized that none of the questions had to do with it. So I learned that semi-ly, if you will, for nothing. And then I looked ahead and there was all this complicated stuff. So I think I'm looking for a different study guide because this one's just not working for me. Do you have any knowledge of any general class study guides?
Comment?
Yeah, person with a comment, go right ahead.
James, one thing, you didn't waste your time if you're learning something, because that form is going to come up somewhere in the future if you're still interested in ham radio. Second, I don't like the ARRL materials. I hate to knock them. They do a lot of good things, but a lot of what they write is incomplete. They don't tell the whole story, and it's very confusing to a beginner. Probably the best primer you can get is the books by Gordon West, sold by the WYI. You can Google it. Just Google Gordon West and ham radio and get his general manual, and it's excellent. And one little trick for ham radio that you do not want to do for school, but you can do it for ham radio, is focus a bit more on memorizing, because in this case, unlike in school, you're going to get the questions and the answers exactly the same on the test. They'll just be scrambled differently, A, B, C, D, and so on. So just get familiar with the answers, and that's good for now. You can learn it later. If you bog yourself down in too much theory, especially at your stage of the game, you may never get through it. So I would recommend Gordon West. He's a really great way of putting it, and enjoyable, and just memorized. Thanks to him.
Further comment?
Very fine, Alan. Thank you. John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I spoke to James earlier in the week about this also. You should try that ham test online. Excellent. When they give a math or any equations, there's an area you can go to where they will show you how it's worked out. So, and it is free to take the first couple of tests, and it is very effective. If he likes it, then he can join.
Yeah, you're not wasting your time, Jim, learning decibels, because as you're dealing with radio signals, engineering in general, and you're probably going to be doing engineering-like work for the rest of your life, if I sense correctly the interest that I think you have, just as Alan was saying, any piece of information with reference to radio circuits, engineering circuits, the way power supplies work, the way transmission lines work, the way antennas work. It's all useful information. And so you'll eventually be putting it all together. Let me drop. On the subject of decibels, when you go to amateur radio, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, that's where all of the recordings of the past TechNets for the last 6 years are available. When you go down that very first page, you'll find out that decibels are one of the subjects that has been separately selected. The Smith chart and decibels has been separately selected. Therefore, you go to that section called decibels, and it will list for you the dates and the hours. In other words, Mel, K2KEY, and I were discussing decibels. I'm picking a number out of the air now. On 2009, September 16th, September 16th, Sunday, and 2 hours and 15 minutes into that particular TechNet, we were discussing decibels. So they'll list them all, if you know what I mean. And so you can listen to the discussion of decibels. It's a very handy mathematical formula that makes things compact. That receiver that you're using right now, between the antenna port and the loudspeaker, there's 120 decibels of gain. To talk about 120 decibels of gain is a 120 is a number that's pretty easy to write. And if the gain was a little bit less, 121, a little bit higher, 122, 123, it's very easy to understand what that means. 3 decibel gain change is a 2-to-1 power ratio, for instance. If you now were talking about the gain of the receiver as a voltage gain or as a power gain, 120 decibels is, I believe, 100 billion to 1. To write down the number 100 billion, and I'm rounding it off, it's really something very different. There's a whole lot of digits in there on the 100 billion. The real hard number for voltage or power gain of that
repeater. Repeater. Cancel.
The real number for the power gain or the voltage gain of that receiver that you're using is a great big number with a whole lot of digits to it. And you could say that I only care about the first 3 significant figures, and by exponential math, you could write it down that way. Well, decibels do that sort of automatically for you. So most engineers will talk about an amplifier. This particular amplifier that I use as a module has got 20 decibels of gain. 20 decibels happens to be 100 to 1 power ratio. In other words, as long as you don't overload the amplifier with 20 decibels of gain, whatever power, whatever signal you put into the input end of the amplifier, what comes out will be 100 times stronger in power. That's what 20 decibels of gain is. And when it comes to describing the distortion characteristics and other parameters of an amplifier or a receiver, their decibels become even more handy. So you haven't wasted your time to learn them. You'll use it. And when it comes to memorization, let me drop one more time. There are people who think, after all of my years of service as an engineer and as a consultant and as a ham radio operator, that I seem to have quite a bit of knowledge of how electronics works. To some people, that is true. That's a description of K2RIW. Whether or not it's true, you'll have to make your own decision on that. However, when I studied for my novice and general exam way back in the late 50s and early 60s, I got my extra class license, I guess, in the late 60s, I did it by pure memorization. The study guide told me that a joule equals a watt second. I didn't know what a joule was. I barely understood what a watt second was. I did it by pure memorization. And the pure memorization for the ham radio test, for a good percentage of the test, is good enough. At a later time, those memorized words, as you start discussing over the air with somebody as to how many joules of energy is being dissipated by your transmission line when you run 100 watts into it, and it's a piece of RG58, small diameter coax, and you're using it at the 432 megacycle band, and so knowing how many decibels of loss it has or how many joules of energy is dissipating, allows you to estimate how hot it's going to get. If you put a thermometer on the cable when you're using a key down at 100 watts. So eventually all these words will start making sense. Don't worry about it. Just memorizing them at first. Pass the test and learn the material later. And so you got lots of friends that are going to help you in all these things, Jim. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, thank you very much. I'm really excited to get my general to get on HF and do some CW on 40 meters. Because most bands are open, or some bands are open during the daytime, but 40 meters is usually open during nighttime, and I'm not, during school hours, you know, I'm not home during the daytime. So I'm really excited. I really want to operate some CW on 40 meters.
And with that kind of enthusiasm, Jim, it's just a matter of time before you've got to have that. And even if at first, the very first time you take that exam, you don't pass it, it's not the end of the world. There's no real embarrassment there. The first time I went down to the FCC's headquarters in New York City and took the Morse code exam, me and my buddy had been practicing Morse code. We knew to get the general class license, we needed 13 words a minute. We were good to 15 words a minute. He said, we got plenty of leeway. Unfortunately, we were sending Morse code to each other with our own particular style. Our own particular style was very fast letters with big spaces in between and 15 words per minute. And when that automatic code machine in New York City sent that Morse code to us at the official way it's supposed to be sent, with much longer letters and much less space in between, we were dumbfounded. We couldn't write down very many of the letters. And we learned a very valuable lesson. We had to go back and take the exam again. In those days, you had to wait a month before you were allowed to take the exam again. Nowadays, with the volunteer examiners giving you so many exams so often, even if at worst you fail a particular section, not to worry about it. Just keep hacking away at it. You'll have it. And all of a sudden, that DX on 40 meters will be yours. Let us know how that goes. Next person on the list was Bernie. Hello to Mike Uniform. Go right ahead, Bernie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Are you hearing me okay before I ask my question?
I'm hearing you very well because I'm wearing a set of earphones. Your signal is a little bit noisy, and the important parts of what you say, if it gets missed, I'll repeat them. Not to worry. Go right ahead, Bernie.
Okay, great. Yes, I'm in Bayside, but I'm transmitting from in my apartment, so I think I'm in a good spot. Questions real quick. You've talked a lot about how the different sizes of the antenna don't matter as long as they're tuned. You've mentioned that many times on previous TechNets. And I just want to clarify, I have a little HT here. It does extraordinarily well with the little rubber ducky antenna on 2 meters and 440. Is what you're saying, if I put on the longer antenna, the whatever it is, about 18 inches or whatever it is, that is not more efficient than the rubber ducky? I mean, this little thing is tuned, and with a few watts into it, I doubt there's any heat dissipation. So I just want, if you can, to clarify, are you saying that the small antenna, without factoring in heat dissipation, will radiate as well as the larger antenna?
You've asked an extremely interesting question, Bernie. And there's a fair number of ways that this all can be misunderstood. When I talk about antenna efficiency, and if I'm using it now from the point of view of a guy who understands physics, a efficient antenna would be one where I put 5 watts into it from my handy-talkie and 4.99 watts of power is radiated into space. That would be an antenna with a 99 and a fraction percent efficiency. That's an efficient antenna. What you and I are hearing about now is how well the signal out of your handy-talkie and that rubber duck gets to the particular repeater. When you put the longer extension whip antenna on there instead of the rubber duck, that antenna could have a higher amount of gain, even though it's got the exact same efficiency. In other words, 4.99 watts is radiated by each of those two antennas, but the antenna pattern of the taller antenna is going to be a little bit different. It could have more gain on the horizon. It also has a center of radiation, which is higher above your hand, because the antenna is longer. The center, the apparent phase center of the antenna is higher in the air, and altitude makes a big difference. So you could get considerably better performance out of the long one, even though they get the exact same efficiency, because the long one has a little more gain and a little bit more desirable pattern. If you now go the next step, let me drop. You go to that beautiful website by Mr. Kent Britton, Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo .com. You go to www.WhiskeyAlpha5VictorJulietBravo.com. Kent Britton sells these beautiful printed circuit antennas for VHF frequencies, but he's also got on page number 2 and page number 3 some beautiful designs for what I call coat hanger antennas for 2 meters. You could, with a slat of wood and a couple of pieces of coat hanger and some side-cutting pliers and a regular pair of pliers, bend yourself up a 2, 3, 4, 5-element 2-meter Yagi with $1 worth of materials, if you know what I mean, and you now aim that Yagi in the right direction in your apartment by putting it on the top of a boomstick handle, and all of a sudden your signal is going to be 8 or 10 decibels stronger than it would be with the rubber duck, because just more gain. It's now a flashlight antenna. Again, nearly 100% efficiency, but now it's got a beam width to it like a flashlight, and you can aim the signal at the particular repeater you care about. If you then go the next step and take that coat hanger wire antenna and decide to mount it on the roof of your house, on the chimney, where it really has some altitude, and even if you feed it with a pretty yucky piece of transmission line, let me drop. You take that inexpensive antenna, mount it on the chimney of your house, aim it in the right direction, and run a piece of transmission line into the house, you will be 10 to 20 decibels stronger on the particular repeater you're talking to. You can now run your handy-talkie at the 0.1 watt level instead of the 5 watt level. The battery will last 10 times longer, and you'll be equally as loud. Because of the extra altitude, because of the extra gain on this $1 antenna I just described to you, mounted on the chimney of your house or put in the attic of your house with that extra altitude, and a cable run down into the shack or the living room, wherever you happen to operate from, you're going to be tremendously stronger. So with very inexpensive techniques, with some smarts, you can make that signal a hell of a lot stronger without investing very much money, and you'll get a lot of fun out of doing it. You'll get a lot of bragging rights out of this one, as I see it, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, thank you. That explains a lot. So you were talking about efficiency, but not the radiation pattern, which will make a big difference. I understand that. But as a follow-up, when you talk about gain, I was of the understanding that there is no such thing as gain on an omnidirectional antenna. Are you talking about the gain that would come from a preferable radiation pattern, as in more signal on the horizon? But I was under the impression that gain can only happen in some kind of a beam antenna, and that you have no gain over an isotropic dipole with an omnidirectional antenna.
Yeah, there's a mixture of terms here now, Bernie. If I bought a Superstation Master antenna, I forget who made it, Communication Products Incorporated, I don't know who makes the darn thing now, the 2-meter version of the antenna that's used on a repeater usually is a fiberglass stick, something in the vicinity of 15 feet high on 2 meters, maybe 18 feet high, and inside there are a bunch of vertical collinear dipoles, 4 or 5 of them. That is an omnidirectional antenna. In other words, it squirts a signal out to the horizon, north, south, east, west, northeast, southeast, and so on. Every compass direction, it's squirting a signal. It is omnidirectional in azimuth. Now, if you use your radio frequency eyes, assuming you could see the signal coming out of that antenna, it would look like a pancake pattern. In other words, it is a beamed pattern where it's squirting the signal out to the horizon in all directions. It's completely broad in azimuth. In other words, it covers all compass headings. But in elevation, it's very narrow. It squirts no signal straight up or straight down. It squirts only the signal out to the horizon, plus or minus 20 degrees, we'll say. So that's an antenna with lots of gain, because it's very narrow in elevation beamwidth, even though it covers all 360 degrees of azimuth. And that antenna can have easily 12 decibels of gain compared to a simple dipole. So omnidirectional and isotropic are very different. Isotropic really means in every single direction at once. A light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, that is a truly isotropic antenna. Every square meter of that room is going to get the same amount of illumination from that light bulb. And there aren't...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And there are kinds of antennas that will act like a nearly isotropic, like a light bulb. But this station master antenna I just described to you, you put that into spherical room, and it will light up the equator of the room, nice and bright, but a little bit north and south of the equator inside the spherical room, there'll be very little light. And that equator will be super bright by comparison to what it would have been with the truly isotropic antenna. So there's lots of confusion of that word isotropic, omnidirectional, gain, pattern, and so on. And one of the things that I've said very often is that if my basis of comparison is a half-wave dipole, that has a particular pattern, and now by very smart electronic means, I take a half-wave dipole and start shrinking it smaller and smaller physically, I'll have almost the exact same pattern if I'm smart enough. I only lose half a dB of gain, which is very little, as the antenna starts approaching zero in size, but it becomes very difficult to impedance match it. It becomes very narrow band, but at the chosen frequency, a physically smaller antenna, I can get a lot of performance out of it. So there's a lot more to the story than first meets the eye, as you can tell, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Jack, it's a lot clearer now. I was confusing efficiency with radiation pattern. But the last thing you said, I'm sorry to hold this up, but if I could just ask you really quickly, the last thing you said confused me. You're talking about a dipole and shrinking it to the point you'll get efficiency now, but you're changing the radiation pattern, aren't you? Aren't you? The smaller you get, your radiation pattern is changing completely, so your quote unquote gain is going to be all different. Isn't that right? So then, again, it's radiating the signal efficiently, but it's not rating it effectively the smaller you get. Is that right?
Unfortunately, it's not right. Bernie, you've used good common sense. In this particular case, common sense will fail you. If your basis for comparison is a half-wave, full-size dipole, let's assume that I'm talking about 80 meters. 80-meter full half-wave dipole is 132 feet long piece of wire, usually parallel to the ground. And if now I start zigzagging it, if I start putting loading coils in the middle of it or at the base of it, if I put top hat capacitors at the top, and if I allow the wire to shrink down from 132 feet down to 60 feet, down to 40 feet, let's stop at 40 feet. And maybe that antenna is going to have a really high standing wave ratio, and I've got a very good antenna tuner that can accommodate it. As I take a dipole for comparison and shrink it to much, much smaller than half wavelength physical size, the pattern doesn't change, the gain doesn't change, the bandwidth becomes very narrow. I can't QSY 100 KC up the band and have the same antenna. I got to retune, if you know what I mean. It becomes narrow band. But the thing that is not common sense is that by comparison to a half-wave dipole, an infinitesimal dipole has, within half a dB, the exact same gain, the exact same pattern. Of course that doesn't make common sense. How in the world can something that small capture the same amount of signal when it's receiving? How in the world can something that small radiate with the exact same pattern, the same amount of signal in all directions when it's transmitting? Of course that doesn't make sense. Take my word for it. We'll study it a little bit further. You will eventually confirm that. The infinitesimal dipole, properly fed, has the same performance within half a dB compared to a full-size half-wave dipole. Ain't that crazy? K2MU, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I promise this is my last one, and then just, you know, pass it along to the next one, but I have to ask you now, it comes full circle to my HT question. So this little rubber duck antenna is radiating a similar pattern to the long antenna. I mean, what you said about it being, the longer antenna being a higher altitude sensor, you know, where you're talking about a few inches, that's not too significant, I would imagine. So I'm a little confused. So anyway, if you throw back to you, and I'm done with my questions for this evening. Thank you. It's really good to get your explanations on this. K2MU.
Yeah, I'm glad you went back to that one, Bernie. I was telling you that when you use that longer whip antenna on your handy talkie compared to the rubber duck, you're going to get better performance in many cases because of a higher center of radiation, more feet off the ground, and altitude on VHF counts a lot. That's one factor. Second of all, when you make the rubber duck on your handy talkie, it is a quarter wave monopole. It's kind of a poor man's ground plane antenna, where the radiator is a quarter wavelength long, and the counterpoise, the ground plane radials, happens to be the metal package that's inside the handy talkie, and the hand that's wrapped around it as the grounding system, if you know what I mean. As you start putting a longer and longer whip antenna on there that's properly impedance matched, it's no longer a quarter wave long. It could be half wave, 5/8 wave, maybe even a full wave long. Because you're going beyond quarter wave for monopole or half wave for dipole, you're starting to get the extra pattern, a 5/8 wave ground plane antenna, mag mount on your car. Definitely has more gain because it's got more real estate. It's beyond the half wave. When you start using more real estate, you now have the ability to start controlling the pattern in a very desirable way. So the comparison now between rubber duck and a great big long whip, as you can tell, it starts breaking down a little bit on some of the things that I said. I'll admit it's not completely clear. Over to you for any other explanation on this, Bernie. K2MU, K2RIW.
Well, I think that's plenty for now, Dick. I appreciate it. I've been playing around with this for many decades, since I'm a kid myself, and it's always fun to learn more, so I really appreciate it. Enjoy the night a lot. Back to you. This is K2MU.
Okay, the next person on the list was John, KC2WGB. I think I haven't skipped over anybody. Let's see, I did go to Vito, Alan, Jim, and Bernie. Yep. You're number one on the runway, John. You got it, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. I have two questions from Nell's mailbag, if you're all set to go with that.
Yes, I am. The way you added WGB to the list, I thought you had a personal question also, in which case you can put it first or later. It's your choice. You got it, John.
Mine's going to be after Paul. We'll get Paul done, and then we'll pick up my question, if that's all right with you, Dick.
Absolutely. Fire away.
Okay. I have a young ham who is working with filters, and he understands how the new software-defined FERP, that he's very familiar with, but he doesn't understand mechanical filters and how they work and how they are built, how they actually function, and comparing them to a crystal lattice filter. He's very confused about that, so maybe you could cover those two in a short explanation of basically how they work. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, mechanical filter, or an electronic filter, but a physical device, a LC network, as they call it. In other words, it's got inductors and capacitors in it. Or it could have quartz crystals because it's a lattice filter. In either case, it consists of